Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Mike Basin. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, General.
Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Oh, this is great. I love it. Been long time listener of the show and was able to choose this episode, and I was glad to be chosen for it because this is probably my favorite episode of the series.
Of the whole series. Wow. Oh, I can't wait to hear about that. Okay, this is a really good one. Episode 17, of course, from season 8, Heal Thyself, originally aired on January 14th, 1980. But of course, before we get to the plot descriptions, Mike, this is your first time on the show. So what is your MASH origin?
My MASH origin, it's one of those things that I was born in 75, 50 this year, or just turned 50 last year. And I knew of this show. Where I grew up, living 30 minutes from the Canadian border in a very rural northern New York, I didn't really get an opportunity to see MASH. We didn't have cable until I was 16. When I was about 15 years old, our local station put it into syndication. And my father told me I had one job to do beyond my normal chores, and that was to record MASH for him every night. He was a huge MASH fan. So
apparently so.
Yep. He was working nights, so I'd record it, and he'd watch it during the day. Well, you remember back in the days of the VCR, that ate up your television. You couldn't change channels. So I'm like, I know of this MASH show. I've heard of it, and I've seen clips and episodes here and there. So I just started watching it and instantly was hooked. I couldn't even tell you the first episode I saw. I know it was the Hawkeye Trapper years, but to name the episode, I couldn't. But I knew I was hooked. I liked the humor. I liked the character development. I liked just the juxtaposition of the comedy versus the seriousness of war. And I know I'm now starting to talk like a teacher because that's what my career is. And then as I got a little bit older, I bought my dad the Columbia House VHS tapes in the yellow packaging, and they were all out of order and cut. And
so maddening those tapes.
Yeah. Oh, it was like, I thought I was doing such a great thing, saying, "Dad, look." And then I remember watching the episodes, even versus syndication, going, "I'm missing stuff." Well, then, you know, fast forward, I go to college, and I went to Syracuse University, and I'd come home and I'd steal a couple of the recorded MASH tapes, VHS tapes taken with me, and I watch them in college. And that was my TV in college. DVDs came out, bought them all. And then I couldn't tell you the number of times I've watched through the series, whether it be straight through or jumping around and knowing I've seen every episode numerous times. As I got older and MASH still stuck with me, I started getting into podcasts, and I found MASH Matters. And I was like,
of course,
because I just typed one day, MASH Podcasts.
That's the one that's going to come up. Yeah.
Yep. And I have Jeff's cookbook, and I bought that years ago, the original. So I was like, oh, wow, Jeff and this Ryan Patrick guy. And I've been hooked on that. And then I said, I ripped through all of those. And then I'm like, okay, what else is out there? And I happened upon MASHcast. And then just ripped through all of these. And here we are.
All right. So, okay. First of all, when you were recording the show for your dad, were you trying to edit out the commercials, or were you just hitting record and like walking away?
Oh, just hitting record. I'm of the mixtape generation. I remember doing that with the radio and stuff. And I probably, when I hit 16, I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing this.
Right. And so your dad must have been thrilled when you started getting into it, right? Because he's asking you to do it just as a favor to your father. He must have been like, this is great. I didn't mean to introduce you to this, but now you're loving it too. He had to be so happy about that.
Yeah, he was. And my dad, he's a man of a few words. He doesn't doesn't say, you know, he's not very big into the emotion or anything like that. But it's one of those things that I bought the Ultimate MASH guidebook for him one year for Christmas. And when I've been down to visit him, it's sitting in a prominent place on his bookshelf. So,
Ah, that's great.
yep.
That's fantastic. So you said, well, you know what? You mentioned this is your favorite episode, might be favorite episode of the series, but we'll talk about that after we do the synopsis. How about that? Because we'll
Yeah,
start
sure.
with that because I want to get to the synopsis and then we'll get into your
Okay.
overall thoughts on the episode. So as I mentioned, the episode's called Heal Thyself, is written by Dennis Koenig and Gene Reynolds, directed by, hey, Mike Farrell. Colonel Potter comes down with a case of the mumps, much to the glee of Winchester, who mocks him for coming down with a childhood malady. Even though Winchester didn't have the mumps as a kid, making him vulnerable to now catching them, he is sure his superior breeding will keep him safe. Klinger is also susceptible, but unlike Winchester, he's taking it very seriously, keeping Potter at arm's length, and he also begins spraying his office with some sort of mumps-killing mist as if he's an exterminator. Of course, within just a few hours, Winchester catches them too, so he is quarantined along with Potter in Potter's tent, much to both of their consternations. With two doctors out of commission, they put in a request for a replacement surgeon, and later that day, one arrives, Captain Steven Newsom, who greets Hawkeye and BJ with the same quick wit, and they take an instant like to him. As Hawkeye comments, "We can put up a sign in the OR, three stooges, no waiting." In OR, Newsom shows his chops. Even though he's regularly stationed in Tokyo, he's a superb surgeon, and he tells horror stories about his previous experience in combat surgery. Everyone in the unit seems to take to him immediately, and his jokey method while working fits in quite well. Meanwhile, Potter and Winchester are at each other's throats, cooped up in Potter's tent. Margaret brings Newsom by to meet them, and Winchester embarrasses himself, assuming Newsom, after mentioning he's from Chicago, is poorly educated. He's chastened when Newsom mentions that he went to Johns Hopkins. Later that night, even more wounded arrive, so Hawkeye and BJ and Newsom have to put in another long session in OR. The next morning, Hawkeye finds Newsom wandering the compound, unable to sleep. Newsom admits that the situation at the 477th is about as bad as anything he's seen. Later that day, there's more wounded, and with some of the nurses out sick with the mumps, OR is chaotic. During one operation, Newsom starts to seem nervous and indecisive, unable to decide whether to try and save the leg of a patient. Newsom starts muttering to himself, staring off into space. Hawkeye steps in, but Newsom, instead of taking on an easier case, runs out into the hall. BJ finds him and tells Newsom that he should take a few moments to calm down, but they need him back in there ASAP. Another badly wounded patient is brought in, but Newsom is nowhere to be seen, leaving Hawkeye and BJ to handle the load on their own. Later that night, Hawkeye and the rest try to find Newsom and figure out what happened. Potter, from the door of his tent, alerts them that he is inside. They find Newsom sitting on the floor of the tent in tears, rubbing his hands back and forth. Hawkeye and BJ try to talk to him, but Newsom seems barely there. He mutters a bunch of random thoughts, clearly having experienced some sort of nervous breakdown. Potter suggests calling Sidney Friedman, and Hawkeye and BJ head back outside. BJ marvels that Newsom seemed as strong as any of us, which Hawkeye responds to, "That's what scares me." All right, so that is Heal Thyself. So, okay, Mike. You said this might be your favorite episode of the series, period. Why is that?
I think part of it, a lot of it has to do with, I'm an English teacher. I'm in my 26th year of teaching here in
Wow.
New York, my 28th overall. And probably about, oh, I'm trying to think how many years ago, I started teaching the Tim O'Brien's novel, The Things That Carried, about the Vietnam War. And I'm always looking for, my way of teaching is helping students see connections between things to gain an understanding. And I was reading, I remember one time I was teaching The Things That Carried a few years back, and this episode came on again. And I've always been, I can't think of the right word for it. I know an English teacher can't think of the right word. There's been something about this episode that just has stuck with me. And I was rewatching it again the other night, preparing for this, and it was the look on Newsom's face when he's in Potter's tent. And Edward Herrmann did such an amazing job with just that scene. And it's that whole idea of the impact of war that doesn't get talked about, but is evident in anybody who's experienced it. And I saw so many parallels between that and some stories and the things they carried that I've gotten to the point now where I show this episode in my classes when I teach The Things They Carried. And every time I watch it, I find something new that just I it just fascinates me about it. And there's so much depth to it that it just seems to it almost seems to be that perfect blend of the comedy and the depth between the two plots and how they're intertwined. So it's truly an episode, I think, that captures everything that they've experienced up to that point, and is actually, I was thinking about it the other night, is such a parallel to what happens in the finale.
Right. I mean, and Hawkeye even seems to, they're pointing in that direction with his final line of the episode. Oh, his final line, not the final line
Yes.
of the entire show. But yeah, the idea that Newsom fits in so well, and he seems so well equipped, and he breaks down so precipitously that has got to be terrifying, because you think, as you're a doctor, that you're handling it, but maybe not. Maybe if it can happen that fast to him, maybe it can happen to you too.
Right. And I think what really drives the point home, even starts driving it home for BJ and Hawkeye, is when Newsom says the Pusan perimeter doesn't have much on what they're going through, where they're all of a sudden they're seeing the parallels and they're like, oh, we're going through some terrible experiences and ordeals.
Yeah. My one complaint about this episode is, well, okay, it's a couple things and they're all connected. Is Edward Herrmann as Newsom, Steve Newsom, is so good as both. I mean, he's a we'll get in his credits in a moment, but like, I've always loved him. Every time he's ever showed up in anything, he's just like one of my favorite character actors. So I love that he's here. The character of Steve Newsom and the way he's written does fit in so well with our heroes that I wish there was more of it. And so I wish that they had done one of two things. Either just kept this episode a one-off the way it is, and way less of the mumps stuff, so therefore Newsom could have more scenes. Like, I think that his breakdown, I understand that his breakdown is meant to be very fast. Like, it's meant to be like he just has a psychotic break. I mean, they hinted a little bit with the scene with the where he can't sleep, but the mumps stuff is so silly that I'm like, they could have dropped almost all of it other than the intro of like, well, why do they need a new surgeon? Well, because Potter and Winchester have the mumps. Okay, done. We spend so much time on that B plot that it cuts into this other thing that to me is so good that I wish they had devoted more time to it. I don't know. Do you feel that way, or do you feel like it balances out?
I understand the purpose behind the mumps part. And it's one of those things that when I think about the episode, I don't think about that part, as much, because obviously so much of the focus with the A plot with Steve, with Newsom, is just, it's such a key thing. But I agree with you. It's either have him there for a couple episodes, because mumps is not something that they're going to get over with quickly, or, like you said, shorten the mumps part. Maybe highlight just a couple things, and you could still have that button scene at the end, that softens the blow a little bit, because it's a sitcom still, sitcom drama, softens the blow of the emotional pull of this episode. I would definitely agree that I would rather see more of Steve with all the little cracks in his armor, but. As you said, Edward Herrmann does such an amazing job showing that in the, I mean, he's on screen for, I didn't figure out the time, but he's not on screen a lot.
Yeah, probably 8 minutes, probably, if you total it all up, you know. I mean, I would have loved to have a scene of the three of them in the Oak Club. Like, just that, you know, like just them. We're so used to the Hawkeye and BJ as the two. They're the leads. It would have been so fun to see, oh, wow, there is emotional space for a third, as Hawkeye puts it, a third stooge. And that's really fun. And we don't really get to see that much. Now, you just mentioned something that was in my notes, which is the other thing they could have done, and I really can't criticize the show for not doing this, because this just was not done back then, is bring Edward Herrmann on for three episodes and start letting the audience think that he's a new cast member. And then pull the rug out from under them, like on the third show, he has the breakdown. Now, again, they just didn't do that back then. That was just not something that television, outside of like soap operas or, you know, ongoing dramas, they just did not do. MASH, I mean, you think about it, like the episodes with Soon Lee, like that's like the only time they ever did that. And that's the penultimate episode and the last episode, but they never did that. So it's not fair to say, well, they should have done something that no TV show was doing in 1980. And of course, had they done that, this episode would have had kind of no plot to it. There would have been no ending to this one. It would have been like, well, wait a minute, they've got the mumps, whatever. But just as a fantasy exercise, what an amazing thing it would have been to bring him in and make the audience think, have they added a new doctor in the on the eighth season of the show? And then whammo. It might have been unbelievable. That just might be, I just want more Edward Herrmann because I just love Steve Newsom so much in this episode.
It's thinking about that, like doing a three episode arc, would be that. I could imagine the uproar that had put, like you said, pulling the rug out on the third episode, the uproar the network would have faced over that. It just because I mean he fit in like a glove with these with BJ and Hawkeye, and meant to be the perfect fit. He joined the, he was, like you said, one of the stooges. I almost think he's a better fit. I mean, it's almost like they brought a trapper character back, but with a little bit more of the emotional stability of BJ. And it was perfect. And he would have been a great foil again off of Charles, even. So.
Oh man. Look, he just again, Edward Herrmann, man, just absolutely crushing it in this episode. And like you know, it reminds me a little bit of many, many, many years ago, back when I had a MASH blog, I did an interview with one of the MASH writers, and I asked him, Elias Davis, by the way, I shouldn't say his name, Elias Davis. And I asked him about the where, because he was one of the writers on Where There's a Will, There's a War, which of course features Hawkeye, you know, and he's writing his will, and we see all these flashbacks. And I said, well, MASH didn't do flashbacks very much. Would you have ever considered writing in a flashback featuring one of the actors that had left the show, like reaching out to them and like, you want to do a flashback featuring Trapper? That would have been amazing. And his answer was very blunt of just like that was not where you were in television production back then. Back then you were, we have to give material to our main cast. We're not looking to cut away from them. And so he's like, it never would have even occurred to us back then to say, hey, let's reach out to McLean Stevenson to see if he wants to do a flashback as Henry Blake. It was like, no, we have to write the material for our eight cast members. And so that's why you could see that they just would not do that. But still, it's a nice mental exercise to think, what would that have been like if Newsom had been in this and on ongoing, but it would be really, really cool. Now, so the show opens in the mess tent, and the doctors are complaining about the food, of course. And then they notice that Potter is acting a little strange, and he, of course, is he's saying his he says his throat's just a little rusty, and he's trying to, you know, BJ and Margaret are like looking at him, and he's trying to head them off. And then she touches his throat, and she says, "No, those glands are like grapefruit." And she touches his face, and he says, "Oh, you've got a temperature." And of course, you know, he doesn't really want to follow their orders. But I love that, as always, Margaret just immediately takes charge, right? I love that. I love that she's just like, she is, you know, she is not, you know, she's a subordinate to Colonel Potter, but emotionally and psychologically, she takes charge and tells Potter what to do. I've always loved that dynamic, and I loved every time that they have it.
And that I actually it was shortly after when she's with him with Colonel Potter in her tent, and I wrote this, just wrote this down, is that it just again shows the growth of the relationship, that it goes beyond commanding officer and head nurse, where there is that father-daughter relationship, and she's treating him like a her disgruntled father that she needs to take care of.
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. So they say they send Potter to his tent. He goes and he tells Klinger where he's headed. And of course, Klinger absolutely you know, flips out. There's a camera angle, okay, courtesy of our director, Mike Farrell, that we don't generally get with MASH over the shoulder. MASH didn't do a lot of that, and they do it to highlight Klinger's exaggerated, where he puts a cloth up to his face, because masks work, everybody, and he puts a cloth up to his face, and he waves his hand, and he is like, command me from a distance, my weak and withering leader, because he's taking this very, very seriously, and he says, I've never mumped, and I'm too old to start, because, you know, okay, everyone realizes mumps are bad. Mumps are back, everybody in America. Congratulations. But here, it's regarded as a bad thing. And Colonel Potter says you have to go find a fill-in surgeon, pull out the red tape, and yada, yada. And then Klinger takes off. And he's literally keeping like a six-foot distance.
Climbing behind the other people, other people eating. Yes. And watching it just here at the beginning, you're thinking this is just another slapstick episode because everything is so exaggerated. You know, Colonel Potter is extra grumpy, and we get it. He's sick. He has the mumps. Klinger is freaking out beyond any part of our imagination. And we're like, okay. And it's hilarious, this setup.
Yeah. So they start, Potter's getting led out the door by Margaret. And then they run into Winchester, and he says, Winchester's like, isn't it a bit early to be in the day to be, and he says, how should I put it, bagged? And Potter says, it's not booze that's got me in the shape, Winchester, it's the mumps. And Winchester starts laughing, and he says, oh, I, you know, I'm surprised, a bit silly for a childhood malady of someone of your advanced years. Isn't Charles really pushing it here? Like, he's really being insubordinate to Colonel Potter.
Maybe he's just thinking because it's maybe one of those things where he's thinking, well, like he does a little bit later, the advanced, you know, he's got advanced genetics, you know, because he's, you know, pure blood type thing where he's like, I guess I can look down on you on this one. But that interplay between the two of them is so funny because Potter is just so exacerbated by him and Charles is just being Charles.
I mean, he is talking to his superior, his commander, though, like, he's really being a dick to Potter. It's kind of amazing. Absolutely. He thinks he can get away with this.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's just might be one of those things that afterwards that, you know, probably Charles wouldn't have done it, but thinking that was a little far. This could be bad if he wasn't sick. We know Charles wouldn't think that way.
No.
But yeah, this is him going a lot farther than he really has before.
Yeah. I mean, just directly insulting Potter, like just directly making fun of him. And so and then, of course, Potter responds with, well, at least I'd rather have the mumps than you, because at least I know the mumps, unlike you, the mumps are going to go away. And Potter gets let out the door, let out the tent by Margaret. And then Winchester sits down and Hawkeye says, Charles, aren't you being kind of cheeky for a guy who says he's never had the mumps? Now, I've had to watch this. I've watched this episode many, many times. Charles never says that. There is no point where he says that he's never had the mumps. In the scene with Potter, he does not mention that he's never had the mumps. So I have to think that there is a line of dialogue that just got cut. And that's what Hawkeye's responding to, even though we don't see it. Because at no point when he's talking to Potter does he say, I've never had the mumps. And all of a sudden he's sitting down and Hawkeye's like, for a guy who says he's never had the mumps, I'm like, well, he never said that. So it's just a mistake. They just edited out a line and forgot to take out the reaction or leave in the line where that reaction now makes sense.
Yeah, that now you say that, I hadn't thought about that because I was thinking just like of the interaction, everything like, you know, between Potter and Charles, but yeah, he died. It makes you wonder, where did they find this out? They're not going to, you know, it's not anything that's going to show up in his profile, you know, in his file. So, yeah, I must have missed a line of dialogue. It'd be interesting to see a script.
Yeah, right. I'm right. I would love to see it. I would love to know where it had to be in the because he's walking towards their table when he sits down. So it's not like he says it then. So he must have had a line to Colonel Potter bragging that he's never got it. And that's what Hawkeye overheard. But every time I've like watched that and I was like, wait, did I just miss the line? And I go back and I watch this. I'm like, no, he never actually says it. So, okay. Yeah. And then he talks about that his superior breeding will keep him from getting them, which is just okay. Aren't you a man of science? Like, what is that about, Winchester? believing in eugenics or something over here. So, and then BJ has a great line where he says, you know, of course he didn't have the child. His butler had them for him, which is a good, good gag. Good gag.
Yep.
So then we're in Potter's tent. And Margaret is taking care of him, and she's sticking all these pillows behind him. And he's like, "Leave me alone." And then she's like, you don't have to yell at me. And he goes, "Yes, I do. I would never hit a woman," which is like that line.
Yeah, he plays such a great grump. I mean,
his
Harry
face
Morgan
is all
was
pinched.
Great.
Yeah.
But he's such a, you know, he's playing such a great grump, and he's a miserable patient, and it goes back to that old adage, doctors make the worst patients, and he absolutely is showing that. But like you said earlier, Margaret's not having any of it.
Nope.
She's just like, this is the way it's gonna be.
It's such a great dynamic. She just doesn't, you know, she bears, and then she kind of puts up with this, and then at one point she turns back to, and he waves her, he kind of sarcastically waves her off, and then he pulls, like, she's managed to stack like six pillows under him, and he pulls like three of them out and sticks them at him whenever he's like, okay, fine. And they've even done some makeup where his jowls are all puffy. They've clearly done like the Godfather kind of effect for Marlon Brando, where they've puffed his face out a little. He barely gets 2 seconds of nap time when Hawkeye and BJ say, "Hey, what does somebody with the mumps need?" His very own roomie. And they bring in Winchester, who is now already sick. Now, we don't know how much time has passed. Like, it can only be a couple of hours, I'm guessing.
Right.
Maybe half a day, but Winchester's already showing symptoms. Now, why can't Winchester just sleep in the swamp? Why does he have to sleep in the tent with Potter? If Hawkeye and BJ are immune, what difference does it make? It just, this, I mean, I understand it's for comedy. I get it.
Right.
But it doesn't make any real logical sense that you would force these two to sleep in the same tent when it doesn't, just keep them in the swamp.
Right. And then they also, even they say that all the other, a lot of other extra tents are taken over by people with mumps. So it's like, he could stay with some of those too.
Like, why pit the two people least likely being able to get along, you know, in the thing? But again, it's for comedy, so okay, it's fine.
And it could be Hawkeye and BJ were just like, here's a chance to get away from Charles, and this could be
most likely, yes, right? They figure, hey, this is our chance to have some, we don't have to listen to the Enrico Caruso records in the tent or everything like that. Potter gets a good gag where he throws it back at Winchester, where he, you know, he tweaks the thing that Winchester said to him, where he goes, "Wow, a childhood malady for someone of your advanced weight." Which is a little beneath Colonel Potter, but it's okay because Winchester was being a jerk earlier, so whatever. So they start setting up his cot, and Winchester notices that the bed that Potter sleeps on is not a canvas cot. It's an actual mattress. And Potter's like, "No, it isn't. A genuine Sears super slumber mattress. Plenty comfy." I love the way he like deeps his word, "plenty comfy too." And then Winchester tries to like suggest that he could sleep in it as well. Like, what?
It's like, knowing Charles the way we do at this point, he's probably suggesting that he should have the mattress and Potter could take the cot.
I guess. I mean, it's like, what the hell? You know, what are you talking about? And so he's continually rude to Hawkeye and BJ, and they don't even bother to unfold his cot. They just drop it on the ground and walk away. And they do look quite delighted, right? They look very, very happy about this, because how can they not be? Because they're, you know, Winchester's getting everything, his comeuppance of everything he thought he thought he was above. So then we're in Klinger's office, and he's got a mask on, and he's spraying the office. And that's when we get our introduction to Steve Newsome, as we mentioned, played by the great Edward Herrmann. Born 1943, passed away in 2014. A ton of great credits, just a couple of them. The Lost Boys, Reds. He played Vice President Nelson Rockefeller in Oliver Stone's Nixon, one of my favorite movies. He was did a couple episodes of Saint Elsewhere, one of the shows that I think is a direct descendant to MASH. He played FDR in two different miniseries called Eleanor and Franklin. I'm a big fan of FDR, and I love any sort of representations of him, and I think that Edward Herrmann is the best fictionalized FDR. And he played FDR again in the 1981 musical Annie. So he kind of cornered the market for a while there when he needed someone to play FTR. He called Edward Herman. Just a delightful actor, charming, radiates intelligence, but had a great comic timing. Just every time he would show up in something, I was like, ah, oh, you know, like it's going to, whatever I'm watching is going to get a little better because Edward Herman has showed up in it.
My first memory of him, and this just, I mean, I'm an 80s kid, was Lost Boys, absolutely. Yeah. Where I remember him first. Obviously, you know, cult classic film, but he was so good in it, playing the double role. That when years later, when I was teaching The Great Gatsby, and I would show clips of the 74 version with Robert Redford and Mia Farrow, and he played Clip Springer in it. And I remember saying, I stopped it one time and in my class, and I went, wait, he's from The Lost Boys. And nobody knew what I was talking about, but I thought it was a good connection.
It's a vampire movie, everybody. You know, yeah. I mean, it's probably his. It's going to be his kind of most likely credit, right? That someone's going to know it from, because that movie has lived on, as opposed to say Reds or Nixon, where most people don't know him from that. But he's just, every time he was in something, I just he shows up in like a 30 Rock. You know, and I already love that show. And I'm like, oh, they got Edward Herman to be in, you know, being 30, right? It's just great. I love it. Just absolutely wonderful casting. So Klinger shows him to the swamp, and BJ and Hawkeye are doing some volleyball using a rubber glove. And they use BJ being polite and shaking Newsom's hand for Hawkeye to spike the ball and win the point, which is, again, very petty. And he's like, aha, 21-15. He's very happy about that. And I love that they don't stop their game to say hi to him, right? I love that. They're like, they're being who they are. Just, it's fantastic. Like, again, the rapport they've all got together is immediate.
Yeah, that's the exact word I wrote down. I mean, you just, it's like you're reading what I jotted down. It's immediate. And he fits in. It's a seamless transition into the group, and I think that you know the bantering back and forth, and he's bringing in new jokes that they can bounce off of, and you can just see they're just the glee that they're like, it's another guy for the act.
it's fantastic, right? It's great. And he says, the nice place you've got here, and Hawkeye says, not much, we like to call it hell. BJ says, we came for the weekend, now we may never leave. And then Newsom says, you're probably here on the American plan, which is, I love that he has sussed out from these guys that they're going to be receptive to that kind of joke, that kind of sort of what some people would consider anti-patriotic kind of joke. And then Hawkeye says, now see here, Newsom, that remark shows a complete lack of respect for this man's army and all that it stands for. And I'm going to resent the fact that you beat me to it. You know, and like they've immediately sussed out with each other that these guys are going to get my sense of humor and they're going to appreciate it. And then, of course, when they ask him, where are you stationed? And he says, HQ Company Tokyo. And Hawkeye goes, Tokyo, hotbed of combat. And they are making fun of him a little. BJ says, you must be working your fingers down to the manicure. Now, of course, if it's the wrong kind of guy, he will be insulted by that because he's serving like anybody else. And then, of course, Newsom runs over there and goes, yeah, it's a cushy job, but somebody's got to do it. I specialize in geisha girls myself. I'm a highly regarded ear and leg man. And it's like, again, he's like, yeah, I get it. Compared to you guys, I got a cushy gig. And that line, I specialize in geisha girls, that feels like a line right out of the movie. That feels like that kind of MASH movie line. And so, just – this, I mentioned, this episode was written by Dennis Kennig and Gene Reynolds. Gene Reynolds had actually not been on the show for quite a while. It's kind of interesting that he's got a writing credit here. This is just great, great stuff. And like I mentioned at the top, I wish there was more of it. I just wish there was more of these guys.
Yeah, that banter back and forth. I mean, it's one. I every time I see that, I think it's one of those things like, where like veterans of war, they're like, did you serve in war? When it was like, I knew it. They just have that radar, that sixth sense about, you know, being able to, oh, this is my type of people, you know, he's, you know, things like that, where we've seen in this series before where they see somebody else and are like, we need to be careful around this person. But right away, the three of them were like, yep, we're all the same. We're all in the same boat here.
I love BJ's line. Hey, Hawk, I think we got a new guy for the act. It's great to, it's fun. It's nice to see them happy. You know, like they're like, oh my God, this is the, not only is he get, not only we have another doctor, this is gonna fit perfectly. This is gonna be great.
And I think that's part of what makes what happens later so tragic, because here's somebody that they're thinking it's going to fit in. We're going to be able to, it's also going to help us get through this with humor and the way they're approaching everything. And he has to be like them for this to really hit home. And the writing and the acting made it perfect.
So then we're then as they're talking, they get wounded. They get a announcement that wounded have arrived, and he's like, you guys don't give a guy much time to relax. They head into surgery, and we see that he is doing really well. He's fitting in. Margaret loves him. She's kind of flirting with him a little. She's like, my name is Margaret. Like she just loves him. Absolutely loves him. And then they're kind of marveling that he's fitting into this so well. And then he finally sort of says, well, I'm not totally new. This isn't totally new to me. I got my first taste of combat surgery in the Pusan perimeter. So let me mention what that is, because that is a real thing. The Battle of the Pusan Perimeter, known in Korean as the Battle of the Nat Kong River Defense Line, was a large-scale battle between United Nations Command and North Korean forces lasting from August 4th to September 18th, 1950. It was one of the first major engagements of the Korean War, an army of 140,000 UN troops, having been pushed south to the brink of defeat, were rallied to make a final stand against the invading Korean People's Army, 98,000 men strong. And Newsom will mention that they had 16,000 casualties in 18 months. That is 888 casualties a month. And that means that is 30 casualties a day. Which is, in I mean, he doesn't mention how many doctors there were, but that is just an inhuman number, the idea that you would have to deal with. Again, it's fantastic. And as you said, BJ says, I've heard horror stories about that place. So, not only are they impressed by him as a doctor, impressed by him by as a wit, but also the man's got some real chops, some war chops going on here.
Yeah, it's almost like, I think back to like the episode or early seasons with Deluge. It's like he lived that for 18 months
Matt,
straight.
18 months. Imagine that. 18 months of that.
And it just what I noticed with this is he's telling that story. He's so calm. Not it's like it's not a bother to him. He's his voice is his voice is light. It's almost upbeat, like he's just telling a story sitting on his back porch. And as we see later, this is it has to be a coping mechanism for him. If if it, oh if it doesn't bother me when I tell the story, then it's not going to bother me. But it also makes him be a lot like I see him being a lot like Hawkeye or BJ here even more, where they're all impressed in what they can do, and they're all impressed with each other and how they handle things.
Yeah, and I like that he's in interspersed with telling the story. He's talking to the nurse. He's like, keep that pressure up. Like he's maintaining this. He's able to kind of have two conversations at once. He has this line about there were so many casualties, mostly pieces, and he says we had so many dead men stacked up like cordwood. And that, for whatever reason, that is a line that has made it into my personal lexicon, and I've used it over the years when, like, there's I'm trying to describe in some obviously exaggerated way, like how busy something was, and I'll just be like, we were stacking the bodies like cordwood, and no one has any idea what the hell I'm talking about because they haven't seen this episode. But it's just me to entertain myself, where I'm like, just there's some reason that phrase cordwood Like what a particular choice of a phrase there. And then he tells this great story about performing surgery in a moving Jeep while the North Koreans are chasing after them. And Mike Farrell slowly pulls the camera in on him as we get closer and closer. And again, it's a nice little bit of directorial, choice on Mike Farrell's part. And we get closer and closer as he's telling the story. And then we cut to Hawkeye and BJ looking at each other as he is telling this story. And he's like, I'm cutting. The kid is screaming. The leg is bleeding. The driver's yelling, where are we? It was a pause, a hell of a ride. And then BJ said, how'd it turn out? And he goes, okay. Kid kept his leg. We found the battalion. I stole a bottle of gin and got drunk. My driver asked for a transfer, and he
Transfer.
punctuates it by dropping a piece of shrapnel in a dish. So he goes, driver asked for a transfer. Plink, just a marvelous sequence.
It's interesting. I haven't in this episode I saw it where, like you said, with Mike Farrell making the choice to zoom in, and he does that to really get to, like, especially with the emotionally charged parts. And I haven't looked at other episodes he directed to see if that's something that was kind of his trademark, his calling card as a director. I'm curious if that is now.
I mean, I have to think that everybody, when they're maybe doing their first or second episode, they're looking for any way to make some distinctions, try and just do something because, again, most of the time you're just doing reverse shots and close-ups or whatever, but anything to try and just bring a little visual life to it. And I said, it's really well done. It's really, really a great, again, wonderfully delivered by Edward Herrmann and well directed by Mike Farrell. So then we go to Potter's tent. Potter and Winchester are playing cards. Winchester's beating Potter all the time. And Potter says, I don't remember the last time I won a hand. And Winchester says, I'm surprised it's happened so rarely. You think it would stick out in your memory, which is like he can't help himself. And then Potter gets tired of it and he decides to read some Zane Grey. Winchester can't resist and he refers to Zane Grey as Tolstoy with spurs. Which and Potter's like he happened to be a great writer, and Winchester is not having that. Again, he can't help himself. Like, just let him read the book. Who cares, Charles? Let him enjoy Zane Grey. What difference does it make?
Yeah, that just actually that just reminded me of something, and I don't know why I didn't think about this earlier when I was rewatching the episode. I forgot to mention it in my backstory. One year for Christmas, I found on a used book website "Last of the Plainsmen" by Zane Grey, and I gave it to my
Have you ever read any Zane Grey? I've never have.
I always meant to when I gave that book to him, but I was in college at the time, or
Okay.
just gotten out of college, and was living in the Carolinas for a couple of years. So I always meant to borrow it, but then it's like I don't want to borrow it and then never not be able to give it back. So I just never
Gotcha.
got around to doing it. I'm not a big Western fan, as in reading them. I like the Clint Eastwood, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and some John Wayne movies, but. To go out and read Zane Grey, I'm probably not going to be doing
Yeah,
that.
they're thin books. I've seen them. Like, and you could see the one at Colonel Potter. They're probably like 180 pages or something. And he's still like in print. Like he's still. I used to work at a bookstore, and we had a Western section, and there were his books in mass market paperback. So he's held on. He wrote a lot of things, and so Winchester says, "Well, fine. You're going to read. I'm going to do what I like, which is play some Mike Caruso records." And now it's Potter's turn to say Enrico Caruso, the singer. And he says, "Yes, I do believe he sings."
Sings.
And Nick's on that. Potter says, "I hate opera." Winchester's like, "A carnal, a closed mind is an empty mind." I'm sorry, he's just wrong. He's just wrong on this. Potter's thing doesn't interfere with anybody. Meanwhile, Winchester's does. I'm sorry, Charles, and it's not your tent. So Charles is just being a twit.
Yeah. And he's been known to do this, especially with his music,
Yeah.
multiple times. The episode with the Smell of Music, it's like, and then, oftentimes that, oh, I'm gonna relax to Mozart, I'm gonna relax, and it's driving everybody nuts, which I think for Charles adds to it for him, his
Oh, I
enjoyment.
think so. Sure, yeah. The idea that no one appreciates this fine art the way he does, that reminds him that he's morally and intellectually superior to everybody in the tent. So then Potter says, "If I want some music, I'll send for my Tex Ritter 78s." And then, Winchester tries to defend Caruso, and then Potter goes, if I want to, he says, if I want singing, I'll go for, I'll get some Mel Ott. And I know they found the singer, the kind of country singer with the funniest name possible, right? Because there's lots of country singers that Colonel Potter could have said. He could have said Hank Williams. He could have said whatever. But instead, they found the funniest name. Mel Ott is just a funny name.
Well,
And then he.
actually, with that, it's Tex Ritter's the singer he names.
Oh, okay. What does he say about Mel Ott?
He
Mel.
says, "If I want music, I'll send." Because I wrote this down as one of my favorite lines, so I'll say it now. If I want music, and I love the way he says it, I'll send for my Tex Ritter 78s. If I
78s,
want a
right?
giant, I'll send for Mel Ott. And
Oh, that's
Mel Ott
right.
was,
That's right.
Mel Ott played for the New York baseball Giants.
Oh my
So,
God, I never got that.
yep.
I never knew. I'm ashamed. I didn't look that up. I just thought it was
I'm a
like.
baseball guy, so I mean, I used to coach baseball, and grew up playing it. And then, I remember hearing this and going, okay. And when I was younger, going, Giant Mel Ott. And what happened for me to click is that I was doing a crossword puzzle and it said New York Giant baseball giant Mel, and the answer was Ott. And I went, I get it now.
There
It's
it
on
is.
Nash.
I've learned something today on this episode. I just never, I did. Well, first of all, I'm ashamed I didn't think to look it up, but I just took the joke as Potter was just saying, okay, well, you're saying Enrico Caruso is one of the great singers. To me, one of the great singers is Mel Ott, right? I thought that's what the joke was. And they just found a funny name. And then, of course, I liked it when Jester's like, well, I'm not familiar with Mr. Ott's work. He's dripping with contempt there. That's thank you so much, Mike.
You're
I've
welcome.
learned something. Every time I watch this episode, I appreciate the joke a little bit better. That he, of course, he was a giant, a Brooklyn giant. Was it when 54, 53? When did the Giants move to San Francisco? Is this pre that?
The Giants, it was 56, I think.
Okay, so they were still in New York when the Korean War took place.
Because the episode, I'm just drawing a blank on the name of the episode, but it's the whole year at once.
A War for All Seasons.
War for All Seasons, yeah. That, they're showing the clips from when the Brooklyn Dodgers beat the Yankees in the World
Right.
Series.
The Giants
So,
win the pennant. Oh, that's right. The
yep.
Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the
Oh, that's
pennant.
right.
So, okay.
It was the Giants and the Dodgers.
Bobby Thompson, right?
Bobby Thompson's home run. So.
There we go. Okay. So, well, again, now I know this. I'm getting new jokes on MASH after all these decades. It's amazing. So thank you. So in the middle of their fighting, Margaret brings Newsom in and introduces him. And he mentions that he's from Chicago. And of course, Winchester's like, where did you do your undergrad? Where did you study? Al Capone University. And then showing that Newsom can just totally go with things. He responds without a hint of sarcasm. Oh yeah, I did my undergraduate work there, which is a great response. I love that. By the way, Potter has this great thing where he says, after they shake hands, he says, "Word is you've made quite an impression on the folks in these parts." And Margaret starts talking, and if you notice, you'll see Newsom kind of turn his head a little, kind of like, "Oh, I guess so." Like he didn't know that. It's just a little head tilt on Edward Herman's part. I love it. And so, and then Margaret goes on and on about him and almost kind of embarrasses Newsom a little and talk about that, like almost Potter and Winchester aren't even needed, because Newsom is so good. And he actually doffs his cap at Colonel Potter being very respectful. So then Winchester does the line about, Al Capone University. I did my undergraduate work there. And then he finally says, I studied at Johns Hopkins. And of course, that stops Winchester in his tracks because Johns Hopkins is great. And then I like that Potter underscores it by says, well, the major pulls his toesies out of his yapper because he realizes that he just
I think that's a, and I think that's a great scene with Charles too, because he, when he's trying to one up Steve and he thinks he has something on him because he's from Chicago and Charles is from Boston, he's doesn't seem sick, but all of a sudden when he gets knocked down a peg, he's out. He's grimacing and groaning as he's trying to move. So it's like,
Yeah.
he's like, "Oh, I'm sick and my ego has been wounded."
It's great. It's really, really funny. Again, I love that Newsom just runs with it. Yeah, so close. I did my undergraduate work there. I just love that line so much. So then they get wounded. More wounded arrive. It's at night, and we see the three of them working on the patients. We see Newsom is like standing on the bumper of a Jeep, leaning over one of them, and they do triage, and then we get our first hint that something isn't right, because as Hawkeye and BJ are running into the OR, we do this hold on Newsom with his back to them, and he starts rubbing his hands, looking a little nervous. And then we hear Hawkeye say, "Newsom, party of one, your table is waiting." And that is our act break. So we
Yeah,
know
we, yeah.
something's wrong.
Yeah, we see, and that's why this was the one, the first thing I was thinking of where Mike Ferrell, as the director, zooms in. We see him lose that smile when he knows nobody's looking, and he's got the Lady Macbeth rubbing the hands thing going on to show. And I don't know if it's guilt for him at, because of what he's having to deal with and all the pressure and all the. But you can just, like you said, you can see that first crack in his armor, and it's a great cut right there.
Yeah, really nice. So we come back, and we see Hawkeye is woken up, and it's early in the morning, and we see that Newsom is off in the background. We see him through the netting of the tent, and he's wandering around. And he comes in, and he says, "It's just a little insomnia, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it." Again, a very Hawkeye line. This scene was always cut in syndication. I never saw this scene, which is one of the reasons why when I first saw it, I was so kind of like, "Oh, I wish there had been more Newsom, less Mumps," because they cut this out. So at least there's this scene. Again, whoever chose to edit the episode in Philadelphia took the Newsom scenes out, but not the Mumps scenes out. So comedy, gotta have more comedy. We can't, this is supposed to be funny. So Newsom then lays down in his bunk, and he says, "I have to say, this place of yours is not a whole lot better than Pusan." And that, as you mentioned earlier, like that's not good, right? That he's feeling that kind of pressure here.
And it almost, I don't know if you picked up on it, it almost seems like as he's making the jokes here, it doesn't have the, his heart's not into it as much. He's like, "I still need to
Yeah.
make jokes, but oh, I'm not going to lose sleep over it." It doesn't
Yeah.
have the same energy.
Agreed. He's doing the bit. He's kind of throwing Hawkeye off the scent a little bit, but yeah, it is kind of just this. But I mean, of course, he's exhausted, and then he lays down on this cot, and then we cut to back to Colonel Potter and Winchester, and they are, not getting along at all. And Winchester's gargling at 6 in the morning, which Potter goes, "It's 6 a.m. It's 6 o'clock in the blessed a.m. It can't be that early for him, right? They start earlier than that normally. Maybe because Potter's sick, he's expecting to sleep in a little later." And Potter talks, excuse me, Winchester talks about how bored he is. And Potter's like, "Oh, no, excuse me. Before we get to that," Winchester tries to share something with Potter where he says he's worried that because of the mumps, he will not be able to sire a child. And that is part of his birthright, is part of his duty as Winchester the Third. He won't be able to have another child. And he's trying to share something. He's trying to be human with Potter. It is a little like, okay, all right, settle down. But you realize, Potter can't relate to that. That's a pressure that's going to be unique to someone in Winchester's case. Now, he's not the most sympathetic messenger for that idea, but I can appreciate that he comes from a world that the other guys just cannot possibly understand. And the idea that his family would look down on him if he can't sire a child, that's an enormous amount of pressure. And that says something a lot about kind of lovelessness of the Winchester household that would be something he'd worry about.
Yeah, and I mean the other thing with Potter with that is he's already had children, and he's already, so he and as he tries to comfort Charles as best he can, but at the point they're at each other's throats so much. But like you said, also Charles almost his upbringing and what he's supposed to do is his duty, where for Colonel Potter, it's just having family is just part of life, and there's such a difference between the two of them.
Yeah, it's a nice scene for how silly all these scenes are with those two. It is kind of a nice moment that Winchester, this is something that really is eating away at Winchester, that he would say, I kind of almost be disowned by my family if I don't sire a child. And Potter tries to say it in his folksy way. He's like, I know you want to be there with at the father-son picnic or whatever it is. So like he says it
Don't
in
want to
a
go to
very,
the father-son picnic solo or something.
yeah, I mean, very folksy Potterish kind of way, so.
I also see that little, just that little scene there where Charles is showing so much worry, where it's coming through the cracks a little bit, is a good contrast to Steve's stress too. It's like here's Charles who's not in surgery or anything like that because he's sick, and same with Colonel Potter. Oh, I'm stressing out over this. Where then you look at what Steve's stressing out and Hawkeye and BJ, what they're stressing out over. You're like, they're not the same. So the interesting juxtapose.
So then we are back in surgery, and they mentioned that they're drafting Klinger and Father Mulcahy, who have not been seen in this episode yet, by the way, Father Mulcahy. And I don't know whether this was Mike, the work of Mike Farrell or the set deck person, but all of a sudden, the OR is staggered differently, right? For all the episodes we've seen, it's always been four tables in succession, and now the tables are seemingly laid end to end. Like you've got them doubled up, and I have to think that that is to suggest the chaos of this, that that's how many, and all of a sudden you've got people walking in the foreground. Like the OR just looks way more crowded than it normally does, and you have to think that that is Mike Farrell trying to get across, this is how many troops are flying into this place. And he does this zoom in through the door as we see Newsom standing there getting ready to go into surgery, and he's looking none too confident.
And that you're right. I now that I think about it, I knew something was off with the OR, and I thought it looked a little bit brighter. But you're right, the positioning of the camera and then the tables is odd, and it's for those of us who've watched the show many, many times, it's very disorienting to see it that way. And then, like you said, we go to the, you cut to the window there, and we see Steve coming in with that pause. And that's something I've seen done throughout the series. Colonel Potter has done that. Hawkeye's done that. Margaret's father paused at, and every, anybody coming
Donald
to the OR, like,
Penobscot looked through the thing and got sick. Yeah. Yeah. So then we are back with Potter and Winchester, and Potter is painting. Winchester insults his painting. He says that's either a horse or the RCA building, which is. And then Potter returns with, "It's a horse. I'm about to paint the back end. Fortunately, I have a live-in model." I like that Winchester does like a fake laugh, and it kind of turns into like pain because he's crouching a little. He's like, "Ha ha!" Like that's it. Like if you have stomach cramps and then you start to laugh, it actually sort of hurts a little bit. So then Winchester finally is like, "I can't stand it anymore," and Potter says, "Take a nap," and Winchester's like, "I'm not sleepy." And I'm like, doesn't Winchester have books? Does it, how is he that bored? How does he have books to read? I don't understand.
If we're a different, if it was late at a different time, he had newspapers too.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, come on, he's got every time the camp has to bug out, he's got suitcases full of scrap. There's got to be some books in there. It can't just all be records. I don't know.
And we know in the finale he had books because he gave one to Margaret.
Gave one to Margaret. Exactly. He's got a whole set there. So he finally decides, I can't take it anymore. I don't care. I'm going to play Enrico Caruso. And he puts it on and forces Potter to get up. And Winchester's like, what are you going to do? And Potter says, I'll decide when I get there.
I get
Harry
there.
Morgan has a great comedy walk. He's kind of hunched over. He's kind of moving his arms side to side like he's like one of the Bowery Boys. It's very, very funny because it looks like it takes him 5 minutes to cross 5 feet of floor, you know, like it's a very, very silly kind of comedy walk, but good on Harry Potter. I love what he says, 86, that Italian. So that's, I, and his teeth are gritted. And then we do an outside shot and we see a hand come out, which is clearly not the hand of Harry Morgan because we
I
don't see
wrote
his
that down. I'm
face.
like, that wasn't Harry
That was
Morgan.
not Harry Morgan. They had somebody else do that for the day. Throw the record and it hits an ambulance and shatters into a million pieces. I will point out records, maybe were records made of slightly lesser material back then? Because like on all the MASH records shatter like they're glass. And my records have never shattered. You can bend, you'd have to really try and crack them, but like on MASH, all somebody has to do is drop a record and it's like like a million pieces or
Well,
something.
it's interesting, you know, now that you say it, a few years back, I was asked to take over directing our fall play. I'm not a stage person, anything like that, but I was like, all right, because I like, you know, the kids, they're great kids, so I'll do it. And then this year's director's gift was a record, and they had broken pieces off of it. It does look like it's broken, like it's jagged edges, but they were very intentional doing it. And whoever threw this, I know it's supposed to be Potter, threw it across the compound. It's going to lose momentum. It's not going to hit an ambulance and explode like it's a clay pigeon.
It is like a claymore, right? It shatters in a million pieces. Like, okay, all right. Again, maybe the records they got over in Korea were like lesser quality or something. Who knows? They're made of not quite great material. Who knows? So then we're back in surgery, and Hawkeye says, "Klinger, how many out there?" And our BJ says, "How many out there?" And Klinger's like, "I can't count that high." And Newsom starts to kind of crack a little, and then he finally says, "Oh damn, look at this leg." Margaret says, "Can you reconstruct it, doctor?" And he's like, "I'm not sure. There's so much vascular damage." And then he says, "No, prepare to amputate." And then Margaret reaches over for some implement, and then he yells, "No, don't!" And we only see, you know, his eyes, obviously, and he's looking very, very startled. And then he starts babbling. There's so many arms and legs, you see, and Margaret gets it immediately. You know, she's like, "Pierce," and he's like, "Margaret, I'm busy right now." And she's like, "You know, Pierce, please," and brings him over. And Hawkeye can see immediately that Newsom is not doing, because he's sort of staring off into space. And then he finally says, "Well, try and save it, Major." And he's not really there, right? The way he reads that, it's like, yeah, he's talking to Margaret, but he's not really there. And then Hawkeye says, "Why don't you take my patient? And I'll take yours." And Newsom responds by walking out. And so, yeah, things are falling apart.
That scene where, like, as Margaret's looking at Steve, you can see he's sweating. Now he's lost that calm. He's unsure of what to do. It seemed to me also that in this OR scene, there was a lot more blood than normal too. And when I heard him say, "There's so many arms and legs," he's not at the 4077th anymore. He's back at the Pusan perimeter in his mind. And it just such a great job. And it's just, to me, I just see it, he's stuck in his mind. And now, as we know a little bit later in the episode, he's stuck there forever without help.
I'm glad you mentioned the blood, because when they send BJ out to rile him to round him up, and he's leaning against the wall, and his gloves are Superman cape red. And they didn't usually, and his smock is covered in blood. There's a streak of blood on his mask. They don't usually go that heavy on the blood. And I have to think that's intentional, right? To show that this is really, really bad. And the blood on Newsom's glove is like glistening. So it is not just caked on there. It is like he just had his hands in somebody. And then there's a soldier go is brought to a seat by a nurse, and he's got this nasty shoulder wound that's bleeding. So they are really ratcheting up the red, which I think, again, I think is a nice touch.
And that little bit on his mask reminds me, and I can't remember the episode where BJ is operating on somebody and it squirts up into his the blood squirts up into his
I
face.
think that's the one where Penobscot's watching,
Yes,
And that gets the blood, and that's what gets him so sick, is because he talks about there's like an artery, and it shoots up and hits him. So yeah, it's really gruesome. And he says, take a moment, but the only way we're gonna be able to get through this is with you. So just collect yourself and come right back in, but not for too long. So then they come back in, and Klinger brings in yet another patient. And he's like, he'll be Newsom's. He'll be back in a minute. And Klinger says, "This kid just came in. The lieutenant said he can't wait." And Elite Hawk gotta go. Where the hell is Newsom? And then we see BJ's getting irritated, where he's like, "Father, go find Newsom. Tell him recess is over. Get him under." And it's just utter chaos, right? And you see BJ is putting one of his surgical gloves on, and he's like angrily snapping it on his hand. He's kind of like wrestling. He probably can't quite get it on exactly right.
And it might have been a little, just a few seconds before that, but it's Hawkeye, I believe it says, "I'm not sure these kids can live without him." And
Yes. Yes.
it's such a great line about just what is going on. And they're just, again, to what Newsom said earlier, they're stacking the patients like cordwood.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really well done. And then so Mulcahy comes in and he says, he's not out there. And they're like, what do you mean he's not that out there? And he's like, I don't know. Where is he? And he says, I don't know. I'll go find him. And they start talking, maybe he got sick. And Klinger says, I'll go try and find him. And then the camera zooms, pans over the patient that BJ was working on. And we get this absolutely heartbreaking exchange where Hawkeye says, Margaret, prepare to amputate. And Hawkeye says, or she says, isn't there any chance we can reconstruct? And Hawkeye says, no, the artery's gone. I haven't got time. I save this leg, I lose that life. That is just gut-wrenching to think that that's a decision you have to make. And right, that this poor guy is going to go through the rest of his life on one leg, never knowing, obviously. But like the idea that that guy is going to be impacted the rest of his life, he could have been saved. The leg could have been saved. Hawkeye just doesn't have the time. And that's just, oof.
And I think that, to me, that seems like that sets up those are the decisions and those are the thoughts that cause Steve to snap.
Yeah.
Is to make decisions like that. And we know different episodes, they have the clamp that'll help them with the artery. And we've
Yeah,
seen,
right. The arterial clamp. Yeah.
yep, we, you know, we've, but when it gets like that, and Hawkeye, I mean, it was written so well.
Yeah.
If I save this leg, I lose that life. And those are the decisions they have to make every day.
Yeah. Hawkeye Pierce was a small town doctor, right? Who probably never dealt with any sort of emergency. And now he's thrust into making that decisions like that. Which is just, it's really beautifully constructed. And again, I'm going on and on about Mike Farrell, but like, nevertheless, like there are some really well staged scenes here, even by MASH's standards. And so, we then cut to, later on at night, and obviously they've gotten through the session. They're looking for Newsom. He's never returned. There's a great little bit of Mulcahy. He is on a bike. Where he's like, he's not in the supply room. I'll check the motor pool. And he rides off. It's kind of like, okay, yeah, the 477th is, probably bigger than you could just quickly jog around it. So he's on a bike. It's cute. It's a nice little detail for him to kind of
And at
ride
night
into
it's
the thing.
filmed on the soundstage, so it's like he's not going far, but
No,
it's hard
right.
to make it look that
The tents are 4 feet apart on the
way.
sound stage, but it's okay. We've seen the down shots of the camp. There's a good amount of material, a good amount of land to cover. So okay. And then finally Potter says, if you're looking for your missing surgeon, he's in here. And they run in and we see Potter and Winchester looking down on him, and Newsom is sitting there on the floor, holding his glasses, his smock is covered in blood. Hawkeye doesn't really fully gets what's happening, and he starts yelling. He's like, all right, Newsom, what happened? And then Potter says, easy, Pierce. He just wandered in and sat down. And they get in closer and they, get quiet, and they say, Hawkeye, and he says, Steve, it's BJ. Or he says, Steve, it's Hawkeye. And as you said, like, you don't get the sense that Newsom's really there, right? And he starts talking about the blood, can't get the blood off his hands.
It was, I think, just even like you said, leaning that just that little bit where Colonel Potter just holds Hawkeye, just touches him for a second, and is like, Pierce. And instantly, you just that was his the power he had as a commander, that he could read a situation and just diffused Hawkeye immediately. Just that little touch, and that just saying, Pierce. Instantly, Hawkeye knew something was wrong.
And so we get another zoom in as he's talking, and I love the speech that Newsom has in that it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I like that because, of course, it doesn't need to make sense. He's having a psychotic breakdown, and where he starts, he seems to be talking to someone that only he can hear because he's like, what do they expect me to do? Where do they come from? And then he seems to be talking to someone where he starts shaking his head and he's like, I can't, I can't, I can't. And he's clearly talking to someone that we can't see. So he's not all there. And then we cut to everyone watching, and we see that, Potter is, they're all taking it in. They all see how that this what has happened. And then Hawkeye says, should we put him on the bed or something? And Potter says, why don't we just leave him there for a while? And then, of course, we get the appropriate line where he says, why don't you call Dr. Friedman? Which, yes, of course, this is who you're going to
The
call.
shots before that, like you said, where we go from character to character, and I noticed this the last time I watched it. I hadn't noticed it before. When Steve is saying it's, and the anguish he's saying it with, and he's like, it's never going to go away. And you see Charles drop his head. He just hangs his head, and like just the magnitude of what they're witnessing. Margaret's crying. Colonel Potter is, he's holding everything in, but he's got that stoic look that he always does. And then, like, Mike Farrell setting it up where they zoom into his face, and his Edward Herrmann's eyes were amazing here. Looking back and forth, trying to see what's in front of him, but he couldn't. And that's where you said he's just like, I can't. I can't. And I just, that scene right there with just him is one of, I think, is one of the best shot scenes, not just in MASH. I mean, that it was brilliant.
Really, really well done. Really well done. And then Hawkeye and BJ wander out, and BJ says he was just as strong as any of us. And the Hawkeye says, that's what scares me. And they walk off, and that is the end of the episode. And yeah, it's a really intriguing idea that, you don't necessarily get warning that you're going to have a psychotic break. You think you might, like you think you, you know, I think we You know, we a lot therapy, I think, still has, unfortunately, in a lot of chunks of American society, real negative connotation to it. And we make people feel ashamed to get it. And I think we all know there are a lot of people out there in the public life that probably need it really bad and haven't gotten it. And Newsom doesn't. Yes, it hits him gradually, as we can see, because we don't really ever get a sense how long Newsom's been there. Clearly overnight, because we see him in the morning. Is this a week? You say the mumps don't go away fast. So is it a week? Is it 10 days? But it's not like, even if you start feeling that something has gone wrong, that you can like steer yourself out of the skid, especially in the circumstance he's in. So what are you going to do? And that would be terrifying to Hawkeye and
It's
BJ, right? To know
right.
that we're going through this, and how do we know this isn't going to happen to me tomorrow?
When it seems to me as Steve's going through it, he's fighting it because he keeps trying to go back to the jokes, and he keeps trying to go back to his safe space. And this is one of the connections I make with the book I mentioned earlier, The Things They Carried. Tim O'Brien mentions in there, they put on soldiers, I'm going to paraphrase greatly, put on an act so that they would rather physically die than die of embarrassment of not looking adequate or appropriate for their fellow soldiers. And it's like they're like Steve's trying as hard as he can to delay this breakdown. And like you said, he's in a skid. And it reminds me a lot of Captain Chandler and Quo Vadis, where it's at the end where he realizes I did this, and he's like, no, I can't. No, it wasn't me. I hope you find this guy and get him the help he needs. And they just, and I think that's where the brilliance of having of Sidney, and even though we don't see him in this episode, we know enough of him that they mention him. We're like, okay, if anybody can help him, Sidney's going to be someone who can help him. And all I think of is in that line he has in Quo Vadis where he's talking to Flag, and he's like, you're never going to get him into a plane again. He's like, we can help him, but that those, Newsom's never going to be a doctor again.
Probably
So,
not. Probably
no,
not.
and it's so tragic to see.
And yet another thing that this show could never do because he just didn't do it. I totally would have been down for a part two where it's Sidney, right? It's just we see Sidney helping Newsom. Like that's the episode. Again, they were never going to do that, but I would have loved it. I would have absolutely loved it. And so we come back and for the bumper scene, and Potter and Winchester have found a way to get along. I do. On the one hand, I kind of wish they had found a way to mention Newsom, but there would have been no way to do it, and that would not have been really ham-handed. So, okay, I guess you'll leave it out. But it just would have been like, oh, then. Well, I'm not a writer, as you could tell, is the line I'm about to come up with. But it's like, oh, I'm glad that's Sidney and something horrible. Like you can hear, I can't even say it, but it's just like. It would have been nice, but I also appreciate they probably couldn't do it. But they found a way to get along in that Potter has got plugs in his ears so he can read his book. He reads a great line where he says, "Never insult seven men where all you're packing is a six gun," which is genuinely a good line. Good job, Zane Grey. And that way Winchester can enjoy his records. And of course, at that moment, the door opens and there is Klinger who now has the mumps. And I kind of like that. Potter has his back to the door and the plugs in his ear. So he has no idea this is going on, but Winchester sees it and puts his head down like, oh, no.
Potter's just reading away, happy as can be.
Yeah. A good comedy beat to end a very, very, very serious episode. We've mentioned a bunch of times already. Mike Farrell directed this episode. I think he did a terrific job. He had previously directed and season seven's Ain't Love Grand, which was very silly. It had some serious stuff, but it was a very, very, very generally silly episode. This one is deadly serious, and he handles it really well. And so I was curious as to how this came about. So I reached out to Mike and asked him about it, and he was very nice to write me back. And he said that it was just the luck of the draw. I didn't request to direct it. They asked me, which I think is remarkable. I would have assumed that he has to do it. And then when I asked him about Edward Herm, working with Edward Herman, he said, "Ed was a wonderful actor and a good man, a friend. Always a delight to see him work, and it was a special treat to work with him." So awesome. Thank you once again, Mike Farrell, for adding some backstage details to the episode. Yeah, he did it. Mike Farrell, terrific job on this episode. And this is a really, really great episode.
This is like I said, as a teacher, I've been teaching for so long. When I think about connecting some pop culture with something I'm reading or whatever, I try to be very thoughtful with it. I don't just grab something and say, oh, this could work. And this episode, just the sheer magnitude of what Newsom goes through, fits so well. And I'm thinking, right now, even as we're talking through this, I'm thinking about other books that I've taught to different classes. Like I've had my classes read Band of Brothers, and there's a lot of lines in there and a lot of things that remind me of what Newsom's dealing with. It just there's certain episodes of certain shows that just go so much farther beyond what the show could even have hoped. And MASH was definitely known for that for a lot of their episodes, but this one I think just really hits home to what they're trying to get at in terms of what's really happening to these soldiers, these men and women, and how terrible it was for them with what they had, the horrors they had to see.
Yeah, terrific, terrific, terrific show. So, Mike, do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
I already said the one about the Colonel Potter line, but I also love when Klinger first meets Steve and they're talking, he goes, if you get them, meaning the mumps, if you get them as a kid, then you don't get them as an adult. But if you get them as an adult, you don't get kids. You just.
I love that he follows it up with "Take that, you little home wreckers," and
Yep,
he's spraying
exactly.
all this.
And it's Jamie Farr does a great job with that, with how he delivers that line. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's a good moment. Actually, my favorite line is from that same scene. Actually, I was afraid that was what you were about to say, because it's for literally the next line where, well, no, it's the I'm sorry, it's the next scene where they go into the swamp and they hand Newsom the martini, and he takes a sip, and he kind of like coughs it up because it's so strong, and he goes, "Woo! Now I know what the corporal is spraying the office with," which fantastic line. Oh, Steve Newsom. Oh man, it would have been great. Would have been great. You could just slot Edward Herman's name in the credits right where Gary Berghoff's used to be. Just put it in right there. Would have been fine. So, well, Mike, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And like I said, this was just a terrific show. And I would not say this is I would not even put it on my top 10 favorites, but you've made a strong case that this is really, really one of their better ones, and not an episode they probably could have done early on, something they
No.
really could have handled later. So just a real winner, certainly from season 8, a really, really good one.
Yeah, that's yeah, it's it, it it's and I think, I mean, if I were being as objective as I could be with a top 10 list, I mean, I'd probably put it in there, but just because of how I've dealt with this episode and broken it down over the years and conversations I've had with students, I was like, yeah, this is the one that just it sticks with me. I mean, episodes like Dear Sigmund, I think, are amazing, but for the comedy reasons. And this one here, just for, to me, the last, when BJ got there, I guess I'd say, Mustache and later BJ, with what they're trying to do with the show, and trying to really show that as the war's winding down, that this is not something that's going to go away at all for these people. And this episode does that very well.
Absolutely. Well, again, Mike, thanks so much for coming on and doing the show. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. It's great talking to you. I appreciate it.
All right. And thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, of which MashCast is a part, please go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So a big salute to Dennis Bailey, Daryl Clark, James K., Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P., Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Shulman, and Mike Thomas. So again, thank you all for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Here we are, sir. Our finest accommodations, complete with cellmates. Gentlemen, I give you Dr. Newsom.
Hi, he's BJ. I'm Hawkeye.
Well, that's catchy. My name's just plain Steve.